Hi, Greg Perry, the Story Preservationist. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 28. Back to horology here. We're talking about the making of cases, clock cases, 17th century, early 18th century, and basing it around the quote, father of time, as many put it, Thomas Tompion. And so let's talk just a bit about how cases developed and where they went from there. So with the invention of the pendulum, the appearance of clocks completely changed. Instead of being fixed on the wall, the weights hang loose, not for the cat to play with. As we said, that's part of the problem, was the cat would stop the weights. A lot of the cooking oils would float through the airs and through the air and gum up the exposed gear trains, and the clocks would not function after probably 2 months. So itinerant clockmakers would have to come around and clean your clock every 2 months. So you'd be pretty wealthy to have that done. Pretty wealthy to have a clock in general, but so then eventually, you know, between the cats and the cooking, the clocks became encased in tall pillar-like cases made of pine or wood or deal, various cheap woods. So now the clockmaker could no longer make clocks in their entirety, as he had done when he had metal cases. So remember, in the beginning, the clockmaker had total control over everything. Now we have two separate entities, two separate crafts, or two separate groups of artisans, the wood case makers and the metallurgist and the scientific aspect of the clock. So they had to, you know, eventually call upon the service of a craftsman who worked with wood. As the demand for both weight and spring pendulum clocks grew, the demand for wood cases increased accordingly. And soon joiners and cabinet makers alike were keeping some journeymen and apprentices at their exclusive production. Thus, the new craft of clock case making came into being into its own trade. So it was a specialist of handicraft in London, which came under the jurisdiction of the joiners and not the clockmaker's company. Clock case makers took workshops near the clockmaker. So obviously, as it was in, we're talking about London here, but in Philadelphia and Pine Street and Walnut Street in the 18th century, you would have had, you know, several casemakers, joiners, woodcutters, and various brass founders and clockmakers. You would just roll the material out of one and right into the next doorway to be worked. Yeah, but for them, of course, they depended on their trade. They owed their origin to the clockmakers, that is, the woodmakers, but sprang from the circumstances of a woodworking craft. Thus, they could find no place in the workshops of the clockmakers whose material was steel and brass. Unfortunately, we do not know the clock casemaker whom Thomas Tompion employed. There is no documentary remains, and he did not leave his name on his cases. So we can also try many times to conjecture whether he worked for Tompion alone or whether he worked for a master or other master clockmakers as well. It is all pertinent to ask whether Tompion had one or several casemakers. For instance, did he employ one casemaker for his standard clocks and another for his special clocks, requiring cases of superlative quality? These questions remained unanswered, and it is likely that they will do for the end of time. In designing his clock cases, Tompion displayed the same good taste that we find in his dials and hands. He was content to adhere to the current design and did not strive for originality, but maintained his own style. His long cases were elegant in their proportion and refined in the details of their moldings. They were never made, for example, so narrow that the pendulum bob tended to hit the sides. Neither did Tompion over-ornament his cases with floral marquetry, a much-liked decoration of many clockmakers in the day. If he used marquetry at all, it was always confined to sprigs of flowers contained in small panels or quadrants, set in a background of oyster parquetry or ebonized wood. The usual treatment which Tompion employed for his early long-case clocks was one of inlaid medallions and quadrant corners of alternating light and dark woods, set or inlaid into a background of olive wood or walnut. He also favored cases veneered with pear wood ebonized. The design of Tompion's early cases followed, like his clockwork, the Dutch tradition. The columns of the hood were often of twist or wave design, and the cornice was surmounted by a carved cresting, usually in the form of a broken pediment, centered by a cupid's head or other motif. Below the cornice was a frieze decorated with pierced fret, backed with silk. Later, around or circa 1685, the Dutch cresting went out of fashion, and a shallow dome now appeared above the cornice of the hood. It was of a quarter-round section with a flat top. To make the hood with its dome more decorative and important, three turned ball spire finials mounted on small pedestals were added, one in the center of the dome and one at each of the front corners of the hood. The dome, as a terminating feature to a long-case clock, was much liked, and soon it was emphasized by being made much taller with the domes. The superstructure became increasingly noticeable during the last years of William III and throughout the reign of Queen Anne. With the domed hood, plain turned columns now took the place of those of the earlier twist pattern. In the early clocks with lifting hoods, the capitals and bases of the columns supporting the cornice were usually turned of wood. Clocks of better quality had the capital and base made of fire gilt brass and were designed in the Corinthian order. A noteworthy feature of Corinthian capitals was that the leaves of the vase were worked separately and built up with the volutes to make the complete capital. Clock cases with Corinthian capitals of this type of construction are a paramount to Tompion's early work. But in Tompion's later long-case clocks, the capitals were of brass in the simpler Doric type order, for the brass capitals and bases gave a more satisfactory fitting to the pin hinge of the door. After around 1690, the Dutch influence declined considerably, and olive wood and inlay cases went out of favor. Cases veneered with mottled figured walnut then became usual for Tompion's weight clocks of the standard type. However, he continued using cases of veneered ebony or ebonized pear wood right up until the end. He appears to have a particular liking for the highly polished black case, enriched with fire gilt mounts. An alternative wood to walnut was mulberry, which he chose occasionally for his long cases. It produced a veneer of a rich, mottled figure. The Japan clock case with Chinese decoration was very popular with the lesser London and provincial makers in the reign of Queen Anne, for it gave a showy effect at a cheap cost. Probably for this reason, Tompion refused to use this type of case at all, for no clock of any making, either weight or spring, has so far been recorded with a Japan case original to a Tompion movement. In his ordinary standard long cases, Tompion relied upon well-figured walnut veneer for decoration, the case being further enriched by the moldings, all of which were emphasized by cross-banding. The ornament consisted of open fretwork in the form of friezes and panels, and the dome was considered incomplete unless surmounted by finials, which were usually plain, turned, and gilt. The fret was backed with silk, which gave a touch of color, for it was often green and red. The reason for fret was that it allowed the sound of the bell, enclosed in the hood or bonnet, to be heard much more clearly. For the fret panels, ornaments, and finials of his exceptional long-case clocks, of which only a few are extant, Tompion used brass, finely chased and fire-gilded, instead of wood. A feature of Tompion's long-case clocks, which shows his common-sense attitude, was that if the clock had a second dial, he very seldom placed a glazed circle aperture in the trunk door. The movement of the second's hand showed clearly enough if the clock was going, and we didn't have to have the glass to have that inspected. The cases of his standard clocks, which had seconds dials, were therefore improved in design by a plain door, unbroken by a bullseye glass. In his standard long cases, the sections of the molding and the design and shape of the domes showed little variation, for they followed the evolution of English clock case making, which changed but slowly throughout Tompion's period. Some clocks were made taller than others, but this was done to suit the customer's specific needs. One wanted a clock for a small parlor, another possibly for a spacious hall or even a library. It had already been described how all long-case clocks were designed with lifting hoods, which, when clocks increased in height, grew beyond the reach of one's arms. The hood was then made to take off by sliding it forward, which was a cumbersome undertaking, and therefore, to gain access to the dial, the glazed front panel in front was made to open like a door. This change from the lifting hood to the hood with a door occurred during the last years of the 17th century. It was not until towards the end of the reign of William III that the exceptionally tall, long-case clock came into fashion. Not only had a tall trunk, but the superstructure of dome and finials was increased in its height also. And with a few of the most expensive and splendid examples, a brass fire-gilt figure was added to the dome, which increased the height still even further. The long-case clock was now thought as a decorative piece of furniture, not just as a timekeeper, as well as an instrument by which to tell time. And care was taken to adjust the height of the case so that it would be in scale with the proportions of the room. Many of Tompion's long-case clocks have lost their architectural domes, owing to their descent to homes with low rooms. Many early clocks have lost their carved crestings for the same reason, although a large number must have had their crestings destroyed owing to the fragile carving being unable to withstand all the wear and tear of 2.5 centuries of time. Cutting a piece off the base was the alternative way of reducing the height. In some clocks, both base and dome have been mutilated. It is safe to say that no Tompion clock case ever left the casemaker without either cresting or dome, for both features were required to complete the architectural design. Therefore, all clocks that have hoods which terminate at the cornice must be considered as lacking a part of their original design. This applies not only to Tompion's cases, but to those of all other makers as well. A feature of Tompion's early long-case clocks was that the case did not stand on a plinth attached to the base, but on all four small bun feet dowled at the corners, like the cabinets and secretaries of the period. But this design was quite suitable as long as the clock case kept within the moderate proportions of the day. But with a tall clock, a case on bun feet became a bit unstable, and soon all long-case clocks had plinths. The cases had their original buns replaced by plinths. Some cases have suffered from alterations and additions calculated to make them more saleable in the eyes of the collector. 30 or more years ago, plain columns to the hood were often changed for those of a twisted pattern, because the latter were thought to have been more in keeping with the period. A number of Tompion weight clocks are no longer in their original long cases, having been exchanged within recent years for contemporary but more decorative cases in order to increase the clock's market value. This has happened in particular to clocks which left the dial and three crowns in long cases of black ebony, the somber appearance of which is generally disliked today by many and many collectors. So that finishes up early cases and how cases were made and the reason why cases were made in long case clocks in the 17th century, and in particular how it was tied to Thomas Tompion. So if you want to hear any or like to see us at the Historic Preservationist, we do videos in the conservation workshop, in museums, our clients' houses, on the topics of horology, furniture restoration, and architectural preservation. So look us up on Instagram, The Historic Preservationist, one word, lowercase, and it leads to an IGTV movie. Up and beyond that, check us out at our YouTube channel, The Historic Preservationist, all one word, lowercase, and please hit the subscribe button. That just piques my interest because it lets me know I have people out there that are listening to the entirety or watching the entirety of the video, such as these podcasts. And these podcasts are shot around the world. And any given day, we have anywhere from 700 to 800 to 1,400 people listening around the world in some 30 countries. So Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist, signing out. Thanks to all for listening.